Forselli and Tirado were returning from a court date in October when Sean O'Toole, head of Bronx Homicide, called to say that Bhima was in the apartment and that they should hit it now. They had no time to plan or summon a SWAT team. When they arrived at the address, a heavily armed FBI entry team was nearby on another job. Forselli asked them to step in. They expected Bhima to shoot back when they came for him. The leader of the squad made an excuse and said his team didn't have approval to make an entry. Forselli quelled an urge to snap at him. In shirt sleeves, without bulletproof vests, the two detectives unsheathed their guns and proceeded in. Moving up a stairwell, they kicked in the door of apartment 17. Bhima burst toward them. Forselli wrestled him to the ground and they tumbled a few stairs to a landing. Bhima continued to struggle, but Forselli had him cuffed in seconds. Finally, the killer who had signaled sex money murder's ascendancy with the murder of Chiron Little was in custody. A search of the railroad apartment revealed a handgun in a drawer. Within weeks, Bhima was in the Metropolitan Correctional Center, where he ran into his old friend Shug, who asked for news of the neighborhood.
"Pipe's moving funny," said Bhima. "Nigga ain't moving like the old Pipe. He don't want to kill nothing no more."
On November 8, 2000, Peter Rolock was sentenced. Carlton Hines's mother put on a crisp dress, lightly applied some makeup, and made the journey from the Melrose Projects downtown to Manhattan to face her son's killer. It had been almost 6 years since Carlton's murder. She kept all the newspaper cuttings about his death in an overflowing blue scrapbook. In court, she took her place alongside two other families whose sons had been killed. All of them were there at O'Malley's request. O'Malley had come to rely on his relationships with relatives to support the prosecutions. When they asked about the investigations, he couldn't reveal anything, so he said they'd have to trust him, but once his work was over, they could ask him anything they wanted. Many were involved in the drug game themselves. Some victims' families asked him how much money or drugs had been recovered and if any might be coming their way. During the case, O'Malley had picked up Damon Mullins, the surviving twin, sometime after he'd been released from the hospital. Stopped at a light on the way to a court hearing, Mullins bounded out of O'Malley's car and ran down the street. It took 2 weeks to lure him back through an aunt who worked in the Manhattan DA's office. O'Malley had to explain to the aunt, who had taken on representing the family, that to put Rolock away, they had to make a deal with her nephew's murderer, Shug. It was a difficult and uneasy situation. He understood that, but it was the only way to ensure that Rolock would be convicted. Ordinary people would be too scared to testify, and the only way to have eyewitness testimony was to get those inside the gang to flip. Many were deeply uneasy with the reality that Shug could cut a deal. This was the unfortunate moral dilemma. To put away someone far more dangerous, Peter Rolock, and to stop the murders of more young men, the feds had to offer the possibility of a deal to a killer like Shug. The family took the news unhappily, but on balance knew they had no choice. Mike Dunkley, Anthony's brother, was delighted that Rolock had been caught. He put O'Malley in touch with his twin sisters, who in time introduced him to Dunkley's mother. She came to the U.S. Attorney's office to meet O'Malley and La Barbera, embarrassed that her son had gotten involved in drugs. O'Malley warned her that she might hear hurtful things at trial. She took the advice graciously, but the family came to the pretrial conferences and kept in touch by phone. The proceedings opened with Rolock's lawyers protesting a section in the pre-sentence report that said he had conspired to murder the cooperating witnesses against him, an allegation that might later have a negative effect on his being freed from solitary confinement. A request to serve his sentence in the New York area was rejected. Next, Rolock addressed the court. Defendants often made a performance of this speech, pitching an emotional case to the judge that they were the products of their environment. Conversely, Rolock was laconic and direct. "I would like to apologize to my family, the community, everybody who was affected by my actions, for whatever it's worth,
and I hope that the government steps up and takes a stand to bring the victims' families, their loved ones, to the attention of the other people who was involved in this case, as far as who plotted, who was there, who turned into government witnesses, the same thing. Take it upon them to look at us all as the same in dealing with this case, and give them a chance to speak as they are doing here. That's it. And then the victims had their chance. La Barbera introduced Kenyon Jenkins's mother to the court. "I don't have no way of consoling my son and raising my son," said Mrs. Jenkins. "He took his life. I will never see him again. He will never breathe again. My family members and me will suffer for the rest of our lives because my son is not here. Every time I pass his room, I go through something. Every time I look through the window and see his friends on the corner, I got to go through something. I just ask God to bear with me and ease the pain. If I may, I would request him to be placed in a special housing unit called a SHU, where he be locked down 23 hours a day and let out only 1 hour a day." Next, Mrs. Hines made her way to the front of the court. She'd thought about this moment for a long time, even chosen proverbs from the Bible to read out, but in the moment just decided to speak candidly. "I know, Mr. Rolock," she said, speaking softly and deliberately. "I grew up with him. His father, his grandmother knew me when I was a little girl, when I had all my kids. I am so sorry for him, but he needs this penalty. He needs to go far away where his family have to spend lots of money to travel. He needs it." She continued, "He needs to be in a coffin, just to feel where my son Carlton is. I had to bury him. I have to see his children grow up. His children are suffering, Your Honor. You do need it, Mr. Rolock. I feel so sorry for you, but you are going to feel what it feel like, but you're not going to be dead. But you should be placed in a coffin for a bed. You should not get out, Mr. Rolock. You should not have the privilege to be with your children." She spoke about Carlton's plans as a basketball player. She concluded, "And I hope, Mr. Rolock, when you go to sleep, that you visualize all the bodies that you murdered, that they come to you at night. That's your penalty. They come to you at night. They haunt you." Judge Cederbaum looked at Pistol Pete and pronounced the sentence. Life plus 105 years to run consecutively. The first 18 months of his sentence would be spent in solitary confinement. Entry into the general prison population would be decided later. Rolock was forbidden from any communication with co-defendants, sex-money-murder members, or Bloods, and ordered to pay the families of the victims $25,400. He was 26 years old. "Mr. Rolock, you have done terrible, terrible things, vile things in your young life, things that have destroyed others totally," said Judge Cederbaum. "I hope that you will spend your time in prison reflecting on how you have both wasted and destroyed your own life, and caused terrible, terrible harm to many other people, both to your followers and your victims. Some of your victims, of course, have been your followers. You are still a very young man," she summed up, "and I do hope that everyone in the courtroom will carry the word back to your neighborhood that the path that you have followed leads to life in prison without any prospect of ever being released." Pete's sentencing echoed around the underworld. Mrs. Hines was ushered out of court through a back door. Outside, a reporter asked if she wasn't scared speaking her mind to Pistol Pete. She held her head erect and shooed the man away. A few weeks later, a copy of Don Diva magazine circulated on the block with Pete's picture on the cover and the legend, "Sex, Money, and Murder, Inc." Rolock's mother had given a full interview. She said, "I'm sorry for those women, but their sons weren't angels. Some of them had murder charges, too. I'm sorry that the other mothers lost their children, but it's not my son's fault that he was quicker. Any one of them would have killed him first had they gotten the chance." Pipe was devastated. He'd never see his old friend ever again. He now saw posters pasted all over the neighborhood by officers in the 43rd Precinct. It was part of Glazer's plan to show what happened when the feds got you. Life Without Parole. Peter Rolock, a.k.a. Pistol Pete. Former occupation, leader, sex, money, murder, gang. Former turf, Soundview, Castle Hill. Current turf, the federal penitentiary. Don't be next. The poster showed Pete in a white T-shirt, staring out impassively with a sleepy expression. In some way, Pete had gotten the fame he wanted, just like his mafia idols. For days after his sentencing, boys on the block noted that Pete got more time than John Gotti. Pipe tore the posters down whenever he saw them. By December, Pipe had gotten word that Pete had been moved to the ADX, a maximum security prison in Florence, Colorado, known as the Alcatraz of the Rockies. America's worst were bussed in or flown in by Black Hawk to the squat, sprawling complex, surrounded by a dozen guard towers, all lying on a dusty plain framed by snow-capped mountains. Pete would see the Rocky Mountains for the first time and last time on his way in. He joined the 1993 World Trade Center attacker Ramzi Youssef, the Unabomber, Theodore Kaczynski, and Larry Hoover, kingpin of the gangster disciples. Pete was led to a concrete cell where all his meals would be received through a small hatch in the door. His entire world consisted of a concrete bed rising from the floor, with a thin mattress and a sheet for comfort. A concrete stool was affixed to the floor near a small fold-out table. A toilet sat in the corner. For just 1 hour a day he would be shackled and led past hundreds of cameras and sliding doors into a small cage, slightly bigger than his cell, where he could look up to the sky, his only view. And his only human contact would be close family members and lawyers. Solitude, for a man like Pete, was a dark, brutal fate. Back in Soundview, his sentence was seen by many in the underworld subculture as martyrdom. He had sworn to be a gangster and taken the oath to uphold the code of the street, for which he had accepted life plus 105. To counteract the posters put up by the feds, someone put up posters of their own. Pipe read one. Fuck de feds, fuck Janet Reno, fuck de 43rd, most of all, fuck dat bitch Judge Miriam Goldman. The author had gotten Judge Cederbaum's name wrong. At the end was one final rejoinder. Fuck all snitches. 7. Dropping the Flag. In the fall of 2000, Pipe discovered that the outgoing drugs he was detailing in his logbook did not match the money coming back to him, leading to a $4,000 shortfall. When he confronted the crew, G.I. and Fat Daddy confessed that a hustler called J. Money was always coming up short, giving crack to his girlfriend free of charge. They hadn't told Pipe because they didn't want him to hurt J. Money, with whom Pipe had served time up north. Pipe cornered him in Soundview on the Horseshoe. "Treat me like a crab-ass nigger." J. Money could keep what he had taken, but he was banished from Soundview. Pipe soon cut the rest of his crew loose. Pocketing $20,000 from the stash, he decided that he would buy his own product and let the old team buy from him, then sell it on their own. He was tiring of his blood affiliation, too. O.G. Mack had been released from prison in June of 1999, 5 months before Pipe, and established his street kingdom on 183rd Street in the Bronx, helping to run an interstate prostitution ring from Hunts Point, directing robberies of parking lots, and establishing a credit card fraud and identity theft ring, along with a steady business, drug trafficking, and extorting drug dealers. But a political rift had been rending the United Blood Nation since Pipe first heard rumors during his prison bid that Godfather O.G. Mack was a snitch himself. The very man who had labeled snitches food. Back in 1989, O.G. Mack had falsely testified in court that a defendant had murdered someone, putting him away for 22 and a half years to life. in exchange for a deal on the substantial time he was facing on his own case. With that embarrassing revelation, many Bloods dropped their flags. Still, Pipe pressed on with the business of the street, dealing, robbing, kidnapping. In December 2000, he gave his blessing for G.I. to rob Queen Bee, a portly female drug dealer working out of Academy Gardens. G.I. crashed into Queen Bee's apartment and took $16,000 in cash, her drug stash, and a .38 revolver. He passed half of the money and a portion of the cocaine to Pipe. Retaliation came swiftly. Queen Bee kidnapped G.I.'s brother, Ghost, before Pipe negotiated his release. But then Ghost and another young gangster, Baby Ainge, robbed Queen Bee and took her heroin. On New Year's Eve, just before the clock signaled the start of 2001, Queen Bee's crew kidnapped Baby Ainge's mother. Pipe and the others tried to find her, but when they came up empty, Pipe turned his attention to the New Year's party. He filled his car's trunk with Belvedere vodka and Hennessy and drove up to Cozy Corner, ready to hand drinks to anyone he found there, displaying his benevolence as OG. But he arrived to find a black sedan surrounded by his crew, guns drawn. Before Pipe could fully register what was happening, the rear door of his car was opened and a woman, blindfolded with a red bandana over her eyes, was tossed in the back seat. Pipe recognized her as Martha. She sometimes drove for Queen Bee. Baby Ainge climbed in after her, jabbing the barrel of a gun at her temple. "Bitch knows where my mom's is at," he shouted to Pipe. Ainge wanted Pipe to drive them to get his mother. If Pipe refused, the crew would question his loyalty to sex money murder. If he participated in the kidnapping, he would be breaching the terms of his agreement with O'Malley and Burroughs. He paused only a moment before driving off. When they arrived at 1665 Randall Avenue, Pipe made a pretense of staying behind to keep watch while Baby Ainge and a few others dragged their hostage inside. About 2 hours later, Pipe stood alone in the darkness. The New Year's Eve fireworks had long fizzled out as the cold swept in from the river. He wondered what the crew had done to Martha. He decided to find out. Inside the apartment, he saw her strapped to a chair while Baby Ainge and another gangster beat her with the butt of a shotgun. Pipe tried to figure out his next move. They wanted to kill her. Pipe interceded. "Listen, man, you can't kill her, otherwise I'm going down for murder as the OG of sex money. That's conspiracy." He looked at Martha's bloodied, swollen features. "You gotta let her go. She don't know nothing." Their decision was made for them when more of Pipe's crew burst through the door to tell him that Martha's boyfriend had alerted the police that a man driving a white Honda, Pipe's car, had kidnapped his girlfriend. They brought her down, blindfolded, hands bound, and pushed her into another car. Leaving the Honda behind, Pipe borrowed a different vehicle and drove off alone. The car with Martha inside had driven only to the end of the horseshoe when police lights burst out of the darkness. The gangsters removed the captive's blindfold and unbound her hands. The police moved in. Pipe watched the cops examining his white Honda from the safety of his backup car, then drove off in the other direction. The next morning, January 2nd, Pipe called Burroughs to report what had happened. The FBI agent felt that Pipe was downplaying his participation. Worse, his involvement in a serious felony would end their relationship. Under the rules of their agreement, Pipe could not commit a crime. Burroughs had no choice under FBI guidelines. He could not interfere, and he had to take a back seat and let a police investigation take its course. If Pipe was guilty, he had to suffer his fate. Later in the day, Pipe and a few others were in a female Blood's apartment when the phone rang with a number they recognized as Baby Ainge's. Pipe and the crew armed themselves and went over, expecting to find Queen Bee. When they pushed through the door, they saw Baby Ainge's mother, blindfolded and tied to a chair. Meanwhile, afraid her son would be murdered or would kill someone else, she called the police on him. He was arrested and locked up at the Horizon Juvenile Center for his own safety. The next day, Martha ran into Pete's cousin Missy, who had confronted her friend when she heard she might testify against Pipe. Martha agreed to leave the case alone if Pipe could retrieve a gold chain that Baby Ainge had stolen during the kidnapping. Pipe ordered Baby Ainge to return the chain. At Pipe's meeting with his parole officer a day or so later, Burroughs urged Pipe to turn himself in. After protesting for a while, Pipe let Burroughs drive him to the 43rd. The police asked to see his white Honda and fingerprinted it. They called Martha to inform her that one of the kidnappers had turned himself in and asked if she could come down and identify him. But because Pipe had returned her gold chain, she was true to her word and refused. Pipe was released and, in discussing the incident with Burroughs, told the FBI agent that he had an upcoming meeting scheduled with the crew to try to establish some order. A half-dozen squabbles like the Queen Bee episode were brewing, any of which could end in murder. Burroughs suggested that he record the meeting. Since the kidnapping, there was an added urgency to their investigation, although Burroughs and O'Malley nursed concern because they knew it would be dangerous for Pipe, despite his authority figure status in the group. Pipe understood that if he wore a wire, he could well be called into court as a witness. Burroughs offered him money, promising that the feds would relocate him and his family should they ever have to appear in court. At 5:10 p.m. on January 17, 2001, Burroughs and Pipe parked a few blocks from Soundview. The agent handed Pipe a beeper with a secret internal recording device. They set up a phrase Pipe would use in the event he was discovered. "I'm going to Hawaii." Not far from the meeting site, Burroughs listened through a headset. Pipe appeared nonchalant, playing John B.'s "Are You Still Down?" on his car stereo with the windows lowered. He parked and entered a top-floor apartment on Rosedale where a few gangsters lounged in a living room. Nut, Mac 11's brother, and Jessica 730, the crew's first female member, who was admitted on the condition that she have sex with the members she liked. They waited for a while for Silk, but when he didn't show up, Pipe pressed on with business, addressing the minor agenda items for a while before turning his attention to the freelance violence and kidnappings that had lately disturbed the crew. He scolded them for Martha's kidnapping, reminding them that under RICO laws they could all be prosecuted collectively for any individual's crime. He lectured them on the risk of informants. He drew their attention to the fact that many among them might turn. "All you need is three niggas in the system to say something about you and they coming for you," he said. "It ain't even got to be true. You know what I'm saying? That's why a lot of times when shit happens and niggas do shit, I'll be doing like, 'I'm saying, Mo, you bugging out. Boom, boom, and you say, play, niggas, tell me.'" Pipe ended. "I'm not ready to do 50 years because you want to do stupid. You know what I'm saying?" Burroughs struggled to hear the conversation over the sounds of gangsta rap in the room. The conversation waxed and waned. Pipe ordered everyone to stop carrying on in renegade mode. He addressed rumors that some bloods were going to kill Roe for cooperating. "Listen, if you feel any sort of way about my brother, I'm letting dudes know now that if anybody plans on doing something to him, I'm gonna kill you, and I'm gonna kill your family. So if you feel some sort of way, you gotta let me know now." Burroughs let his head fall into his hands. The last thing he wanted was a cooperating witness making threats to kill. After the tirade, a silence fell. Only one gangster spoke. "I ain't got no problems out of respect for you," he said. "But everyone else telling, like Suge, I got a problem with." Concern was raised over the number of bloods now selling on Cozy Corner in competition with each other. "This shit is real, Mo," said one. "Niggas gonna get knocked on the block, yo. They come to the block, they see 40 niggas, Mo, with 7 different types of work." The decision was made to move all the sales into Papayalas to avoid the police. When sex money murder was under pressure, they always moved all their sales into the store, but inevitably one or two drifted back out to Cozy Corner to sell because it was easier and customers were more plentiful. The meeting, originally scheduled to take a few minutes, went on for hours. And then a sudden high-pitched shriek emanated from Pipe's beeper. Everyone looked at him quizzically. Pipe's blood turned to ice. Would they suspect? He looked to see who might have a gun he could grab. Hurriedly, He called the meeting to a close and scurried away.
"What the fuck, Dave?"
said Pipe, exasperated, when he got back into the car. Because the meeting had gone on so long, the battery had died, emitting the sound. Pipe drank a bottle of cognac that night to settle his nerves. After the recording revealed the gang's plans to focus more on selling out of Papayalas, Forselli approached the owners about the possibility of placing clandestine surveillance cameras there. The owner's son immediately relayed the intelligence to Pipe. He shifted plans and told the crew to hustle out of the liquor store next door. But Burroughs and Forselli, already suspecting that their intentions had been revealed, placed cameras there. The owners were terrified of the crew and had refused to cooperate, but the FBI had applied for a warrant and did the installation regardless. Crucially, Burroughs didn't tell Pipe. Forselli had the unenviable task of watching endless hours of crack sales on surveillance footage. One corner of the store offered a secluded spot out of sight of the camera. Tirado installed a large potted plant to force the hustlers to move to the center of the store to make their transactions. Forselli knew every hustler on site, often just by the way they shuffled, moved their hands, or held their head. They sometimes kept the crack secreted in their anal cavity. Every so often, they'd fish it out from the back of their underpants and hand it to the clientele. Sometimes Forselli had Burroughs take over. He'd watch the tape up in his office, praying he would never see footage of Pipe, with whom he'd grown close. But eventually, he came to footage from February 7, 2001, which clearly showed Pipe at 5:35 p.m., selling to a disheveled-looking man, and then to a woman who put the crack in her bra before handing Pipe money. The FBI agent cursed under his breath and hurriedly rewound the tape to watch it again. Burroughs felt sorry for Pipe. He'd come to like the young man. But he'd have to face his fate with the rest of his crew now. And that made Burroughs look bad as Pipe's handler. Any defense lawyer could exploit the fact of a cooperating witness using federal money to buy and sell crack to undermine a prosecution. He called O'Malley, who wasn't surprised. There was some dispute in the office as to how to handle Pipe. Many felt that his agreement should be torn up. But in the meantime, he would be targeted just like any other dealer in the federal sweep of mass arrests of sex money murder that was about to move through Soundview. On the day he was caught on camera, Pipe grinned when he saw crackhead BMO come into the liquor store. The old-timer was legendary in Soundview history, and in some sense the personification of the neighborhood. His twinkling eyes and easy laughter always made Pipe feel at home. Crackhead BMO's rap sheet ran to 30 pages and 54 arrests. He'd been in and out of prison 5 times himself. Out of respect for the OG and for a few grams of crack, he made sure no one broke into Pipe's cars. This loose arrangement didn't mean that BMO wouldn't steal from other cars, but he was so beloved that most people left him alone. His victims turned a blind eye, some from fear, others out of loyalty to one of their own. Pipe slipped BMO a couple of dimes of crack in the liquor store, completely unaware that he was being recorded. In an ironic twist, crackhead BMO had been Pipe's first mentor in the drug game, and now he would end Pipe's drug-dealing career. 3 months later, in early May, as the feds laid plans to pounce in Soundview, Pipe was slumbering in his apartment when the phone rang. Crackhead BMO had been breaking into a car for a stereo when a part-time school bus driver, Victor Vicente, aimed a .22-caliber rifle from his apartment window and shot him in the head, killing him instantly. Within hours, death threats poured in against Vicente, who faced charges of second-degree murder. He and his family were hustled out of the neighborhood under police protection. Pipe wandered up to Cozy Corner, where 2 dozen votive candles and some flowers littered the sidewalk. The owner of the pizza shop where Pipe had first hustled with crackhead BMO told a reporter from the New York Post that he had probably given the old-timer 2,000 free pieces of pizza in his lifetime. "I miss him already," he lamented, in a story headlined, "Urban Legend Fell Victim to His Own Myth." Kids in the neighborhood went door to door collecting for his funeral. Forselli and his partner Pat Kelly mourned his loss. They'd both helped Bimo out when he'd been beaten up for selling breadcrumbs as crack, or was down on his luck and had no food. They bought him lunch and gave him a few dollars on occasion. His body was embalmed at R.G. Ortiz on Soundview Avenue, the same funeral parlor one-time SMM O.G. Bear had also passed through. Within a few days, he was laid in a casket, dressed in a tuxedo, hands folded over his chest. A public defender who had come to know and love Bimo gave a beautiful eulogy at the packed funeral. Crackhead Bimo's demise, the abrupt, violent death of Soundview's soothsayer, marked a metaphorical denouement in the crack epidemic. The term crackhead now had such a negative connotation in the neighborhoods across New York that it repulsed youths who might be the new generation of addicts. The market for crack had dwindled significantly. These days, kids smoked blunts and drank 40-ounce bottles of malt liquor. As they put Bimo to rest, no one in the new generation could aspire to be like him. Pipe brooded at the symbolism of crackhead Bimo's death while he and others stood on Cozy Corner and offered libations to the dead man, splashing Hennessy on the sidewalk. Pipe felt that Soundview should have been safe for crackhead Bimo. His death caused Pipe to wonder if everyone had something to fear. The feds planned to execute their takedown on May 31, 2001, about 3 weeks after crackhead Bimo's murder. Burroughs and La Barbera went to the grand jury and secured indictments. They wanted Nutt, who had murdered Tony Morton. Normally, arrests by a squadron of granite-faced FBI agents in dark blue raid jackets would follow a federal indictment, but Forselli convinced Burroughs that as soon as word leaked out that the feds were on the block, the neighborhood would empty out. They'd be lucky to make two arrests. Instead, he proposed sending in plainclothes housing cops, the same ones the gangsters greeted with weary disdain every day. To Forselli's surprise, Burroughs agreed. Forselli prepared for Operation Cozy Corner with something of a heavy heart. After the operation, he'd be moving on from the NYPD. The work of fighting gangs through the federal operation had given him the idea of applying to the ATF, and he was starting June 4th. Sorry as he was to leave the NYPD, he couldn't go back now to the revolving door convictions, the dealers and killers back on the street soon after their arrest, the poisonous relationship between the DA and the police. This would be Forselli's swan song, the final takedown of a crew that had hovered over his whole career in the Bronx. He'd wanted to make arrests personally. Only he could identify all the sex money murder suspects for the arrest teams. Instead, to his chagrin, he'd be parked in the surveillance van a few blocks away from Papayala's as a forward observer pointing out targets. At the morning briefing, a dozen pictures of sex money murder gang members were circulated to three teams of six plainclothes officers. In all police operations, a color of the day was worn on the wrist to mark officers on the team. If they had to open fire, the band would reveal that they were police so that no one would be shot in the confusion. Today it was green. In reality, most cops lost the bands and it became a formality. Sergeant Paul Marin of the Scorpio 1 arrest team bantered with his counterpart in Scorpio 2, Lieutenant George Duquette. "We're going to get more than you," they said, laying bets. "We're going to crush you guys." Forselli had made a decision to go out with a celebratory buffet. He went to Joe's Deli on Tremont Avenue, where he bought a container of seasoned mozzarella, a tub of stuffed cherry peppers, and a 3-foot-long hero. At around 1 p.m., he climbed into the surveillance van and, for the last time in his NYPD career, drove into Soundview. He parked two blocks from the liquor store, pulled down a folding counter, and laid out his food. As he looked out, he reminisced on the countless arrests made here. They had barely dented the crime rate in the neighborhood. And then he'd linked up with O'Malley. At around 2:30 p.m., Forselli spotted the first hustler through a periscope that provided a 360-degree view of the street. He called it in over the radio, and an arrest team moved in. They told the perp that they were arresting him over an outstanding warrant, rather than sounding the alarm by announcing the federal operation. Plainclothes officers pounced on Pipe, his cousin Scruff, and another man in papayalas. Pipe glared from beneath the brim of a red New York Yankees cap. A third man with Pipe, a music agent, protested, saying that he was here with his artist, indicating Pipe. The detectives let Pipe go, but took his cousin away in handcuffs. When they left, Pipe sprinted to his baby mother's apartment, passing Forselli's van on the way. Forselli had told the arrest team not to take the guy in the red Yankees hat, because if the OG got snatched from the block early in the morning, the game would be up. Pipe returned to the block later that afternoon to watch as detectives grabbed the brothers Venom and baby-faced gangsta. He called G.I., who said that an undercover police car was parked outside his building. Something big was going down. Pipe drove away from the neighborhood without a plan. As he headed up Lacombe to the intersection of Commonwealth behind the projects, a tinted-out Crown Victoria, unmistakably a federal car, sat in the middle of the street. Pipe took a hard left down the block only to see more unmarked policemen coming toward him. He jumped a stop sign before slamming to a halt outside his apartment and running upstairs. "The police are chasing me," he told Chantal when he came inside. "I'm going to run." Chantal broke down in tears. She said they had been unable to find Scruff at the 43rd.
"Don't leave," she screamed.
Pipe brushed her off. Outside, an old friend sat idling in his car on the block. Pipe asked the friend if he could drive him to pick up his Acura at a local car shop. They ducked down some streets and then pulled up on an apron of concrete in front. The place was closed. Suddenly, from behind, Pipe caught sight of a team of FBI agents with AR-15 assault rifles trained on him.
"Bronx Homicide Task Force!"
Another,
"FBI!"
Pipe emerged from the car with his hands up.
"What's your name?" barked one of the men.
Pipe responded. The men mumbled something about a parole violation. Pipe lost his temper.
"Ain't no way in hell I got a parole warrant," he countered.
Pipe knew that FBI teams didn't make armed arrests for parole violations. This, he knew, was the beginning of the end. Early in the day, Forselli had caught sight of two black men in their 50s sitting in lawn chairs outside the liquor store, drinking from brown paper bags. Every time a sex money murder gangster was arrested, they laughed. Forselli panicked, fearing that they would alert the neighborhood to the cops. But when he called in yet another arrest, they did the unthinkable. They raised their bottles to the van in celebration. So in the last hours of his last watch, as another raised beer can went up to him on another arrest, he chose to see that the people of Soundview were thanking him. Pipe was taken to the 48th precinct. In the cramped chaos, he passed Scruff being led out of an interrogation room. His cousin shook his head, offering just two words, "Big boy." The case was federal. After booking, Pipe was taken to a back room where he came face to face with his friend Burroughs. Pipe knew, somehow, that the agent had found out about the dealing he had done. "I already know what you're going to say, Dave," he said sheepishly. "I know you gotta do what you gotta do. I'm really sorry, man." Burroughs knew how this would play out for Pipe. He'd be charged the same as the rest of them, despite his confidential informant status. Pipe was pushed into a holding cell with the rest of the crew. A police radio crackled long into the night with the news of more arrests. At around 10 p.m., police descended on an address on Gun Hill Road where they caught Nutt naked in bed with a young woman. "Suspect is unclothed," said the police radio. Pipe snickered. An hour or so later, Nutt entered the holding cell.
"Niggas bust in the crib and I'm butt naked," he raged. "What the fuck is this bullshit, anyway?"
At around 11, Burroughs went to McDonald's and bought 20 quarter-pounders out of his own pocket for the gangsters, which they devoured. The following morning, after a session in front of the magistrate, they were all driven south to the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn. There, Pipe met Baby Jay, who complained that Shug, his former lieutenant, had confessed everything to O'Malley and caused his downfall. By the time he got picked up, Baby had almost crossed over into legitimacy. He'd moved to a middle-class housing development in the Rockland County town of Nanuet, New York, and taken out a mortgage on a half-million-dollar home. 5 months earlier, O'Malley had surveilled the house for several days before swooping in and searching to no avail. He and his partners couldn't find Baby. O'Malley nonetheless suspected that he was in the house somewhere.
"That's it," shouted O'Malley, standing in the sumptuous living room. "Send in the dogs. They'll tear his ass up."
He winked at one of the cops. They had no dogs, but from deep within a crawlspace came rustling and then a muffled shout.
"Okay, okay."
Baby Jay emerged. In the days ahead, Pipe and 12 other members of Sex Money Murder stood in Judge Thomas Grease's courtroom on the 26th floor of the Foley Square Courthouse, one of the grandest courts in the building, with views north to the Empire State Building and beyond. Pipe was assigned the veteran defense lawyer John Jacobs and his junior assistant Stephanie Plowman straight out of Brooklyn Law School. She hadn't yet received her bar results. As she and Pipe got to know each other, he had to explain to her what the term OG meant. In June 2001, in the same spot on Cozy Corner where Robert Moses had sat for the groundbreaking ceremony of the Soundview Houses, another ceremony began. Forselli, La Barbera, Bob Ryan, and U.S. Attorney Mary Jo White sat amid lines of folding chairs facing a wooden rostrum with a placard that read, "Now Entering a Weed and Seed Community." In the wake of the weeding of Sex Money Murder, federal grant money had been siphoned to the Bronx DA, who in turn had set up a safe haven for children for after-school homework mentoring and some gardening and computer classes. Police officers had volunteered to teach kids karate and basketball. Thinking that the neighborhood was now safe, one woman had called the police about some gangsters who hustled near the front of her house. The following night, a dead rat was thrown at her door. Before the ceremony, O'Malley arranged for a heavy police presence. He liked the idea of weed and seed, but he suspected that the neighborhood would go back to its old ways, within weeks, if not days or hours. Weed and seed organizers sensed the danger that neighborhood residents would face if they painted over the SMM graffiti at Cozy Corner, wiping out the names of dead gangsters. So they bussed in federal prisoners on probation from other boroughs to do the job. Students from IS 131 painted a vibrant jungle scene and an image of some visitors looking at paintings in an art gallery. A grocer on Cozy Corner gave the kids free drinks and sandwiches for their efforts. As they worked, a drug dealer in a glossy black car slowed alongside. Two suspected bloods walked past and made threats. And then, 3 weeks before the weed and seed ceremony, the mural was splashed with pink paint. When they repaired the damage, it was defaced again. Finally, members of the National Guard were called in to paint. As the ceremony got underway, Mary Jo White unveiled the mural. "Where the violent sex, money, and murder gang once imposed its will and blatantly marked its territory, students of nearby 131 have now made their own proud and positive statement," she said. "This latest indictment, together with the spirit represented by the wonderful murals, hopefully signals the end of the SMM gang and a new bright beginning for the neighborhood." O'Malley and Forselli looked out on the neighborhood. Behind the Soundview houses was Clayson Point Gardens, a well-tended collection of two-story row houses, each with a small garden. O'Malley's grandmother had lived there, and he'd played in their shadow growing up. Clayson Point Gardens and Soundview both had low-income residents, but Forselli had rarely been called to Clayson Point during his career. In 1969, the city planner and architect Oscar Newman redesigned the area, giving residents a greater personal stake in their homes. After his improvements, the overall crime rate in Clayson Point Gardens dropped 54% in the first year. Looking up at the Soundview houses around him, Forselli wondered if, given those same housing opportunities, the lives of people here could be improved. Toward the end of the weed and seed ceremony, several key members of the community expressed their gratitude to the prosecution team, who were handed awards for their work. One man approached Forselli in tears. His children were now safe to take the bus to school, he said. In the weeks following, the mural would be defaced yet again. A reporter with the Daily News tracked down one man who refused to be named, but explained why he preferred the old mural. It had the names of guys who were significant to the neighborhood. This stuff don't mean anything to us. On July 31, 2001, guards came to the cell at Brooklyn's Metropolitan Detention Center that Pipe shared with one of his co-defendants, G.I. But this time they only called G.I. for a court appearance. In the MDC, defendants who weren't called to court with their co-defendants inspired suspicion. Yet Pipe had not made a deal. In court, Chantal waited to catch a glimpse of Pipe. She did her hair and nails before every court appearance and bustled around among the other girlfriends and mothers, offering help and counsel to those who hadn't been there before. Today, Chantal sat jammed in with other Soundview relatives and friends on polished wooden benches in the public gallery as the crew was led out by the marshals. But this time Pipe wasn't among them. Chantal craned her neck, astonished. Quickly, she sensed a rising discomfort from the other families around her. People shot her looks. Chantal stared ahead. Then people began to gather their things to move to the other side of the courtroom. Within a few minutes, Chantal was alone. At the end of the session, the marshals noted the commotion in the public gallery and escorted Chantal out. Back on the cell block, Pipe's cellmate returned and told him word was out that he was cooperating. Pipe caught dirty looks from Peter and Carmine Agnello, John Gotti's son and son-in-law. The Italians periodically sent out flunkies to engage other inmates in conversation or do them favors while trawling for information. Pipe had honed his disposition in prison. He walked with a stiff back and swiveled his eyes around any area he entered to let others know that he was aware of their presence. Sometimes he might throw out a smirk to suggest that he knew something he didn't. He kept to himself, stayed out of the mix, and observed. In time, he learned that the officers had left him out of the hearing because of an administrative error. But the damage was done. A month or so later, ostensibly called out for a bail hearing, he found himself in one of the proffer rooms at the U.S. Attorney's Office, face to face with O'Malley once more. La Barbera was there, and Pipe was joined by his lawyer, Stephanie Plowman. "I told you I would see you again," O'Malley said. Pipe sneered, but everything that O'Malley had predicted when they'd first met in Cayuga had come true. Pipe had few cards left to play. The two men stared at each other. Pipe had lied and used deceit as a way to make his living for years. He'd risen to OG and managed to play the feds and his crew. One slip, and he easily could have been found behind the projects with a bullet in the back of his head, his body all but forgotten, like Anthony Dunkley's. But he had survived at the top. For his part, O'Malley had flipped hundreds of men since he'd started at the U.S. Attorney's Office in 1995. Despite Pipe's double-dealing, La Barbera had fought to give him a chance. The office remained sharply divided between those who believed he should never be trusted again and those who argued for a second chance. La Barbera had forged a good relationship with Pipe's brother, knew a lot about the family, and sensed that Pipe would not only be useful but might be capable of redemption. She knew about Pipe's parents and how they had struggled to raise the family, but she felt that he would be a more sophisticated and dangerous person than Roe. At first they all made small talk. La Barbera wanted to know how he had gotten his nickname. O'Malley joked that it was because he lays a lot of pipe and made a sexually suggestive gesture with his hands. They all laughed. Pipe was grateful for the levity before the session began. They wanted to know about Nutt, the only one of the crew accused of murder in the indictment for the killing of Tony Morton. Pipe said that he might help, but that they needed to move Chantal out of Soundview, something that had been promised when he assisted as a confidential informant. And he told them, irritably, to always bring him out to court with his co-defendants. "You made me hot," he complained. O'Malley pushed Pipe to admit that he was an eyewitness to Morton's murder. Pipe began to weave a lie. He said that he had seen Nutt bicycle up to the scene, but that when the shots went off, his vision had been obscured. The investigators stopped writing. O'Malley's unyielding, cold blue eyes bored into him. He'd seen this 100 times. The low voice, lack of eye contact, and fidgeting. Everything would have to be turned over to the defense. A lie like this, if consigned to paper, would destroy Pipe's credibility in front of a jury. "You're lying," rumbled O'Malley. "You're fucking lying. You saw exactly what happened." Pipe stared ahead. O'Malley could visualize the crime scene in his mind, saw Pipe walking up the flat expanse of Rosedale Avenue, and knew from what he had described before that Pipe had watched Nutt murder Morton. Proffers were the ultimate chess match. Abruptly, the session ended. O'Malley stood up and unlocked Pipe's handcuffs. He told Plowman to explain to her client the seriousness of proffers. And then in seconds, Pipe found his wrists handcuffed again. O'Malley led him out of the room, heading for the MDC. As they started across the overpass, the two were alone. The bridge between free world and prison was the best place to talk sense into a potential cooperator. Up ahead was a reinforced door that led to federal incarceration. Here, out of earshot of attorneys, O'Malley could talk frankly. This time, knowing Pipe as he did after their conversations on the Clayson Point waterfront, he scolded him viciously. No one had ever spoken to Pipe this way. O'Malley told him that he'd lose the opportunity to get a cooperation agreement by bullshitting like that. Worse, he was jeopardizing everything with blatant lies. There was no laughing now. "You protecting someone, huh, Pipe?" Pipe returned to the cell and turned it all over in his mind. His bravura won out. He felt he could win at trial. The feds had little on him besides the drug dealing. But a few days later, his lawyer received a call from La Barbera. They were going to release to the other defendants' lawyers the secret recording Pipe had made with the wire. It would be part of the so-called 3500 material, the prior statements of government witnesses. Pipe's lawyers raced over to the MDC the next day. Neither of them knew anything about a recording. John Jacobs was an old-school lawyer who disliked rats as much as the gangsters did. He was astonished to hear that Pipe had made a recording for the feds. Pipe complained that he'd been bamboozled, that the feds had told him it would never be released. As Pipe was reassessing O'Malley's offer to cooperate, a letter from someone inside the MDC arrived in his cell. If inmates wanted to send each other notes, they would write a return address on an envelope in the top left-hand corner, which would actually be the inmate they wanted a letter to reach, while purposefully omitting a real addressee. The mailroom clerk would assume a mistake had been made and return the letter to the sender. Pipe read a corrosive letter from a gangster in the Monroe houses that cursed him for snitching. The gangster said that he knew where the safe in Pipe's house was and that his crew was going to break into the apartment. If they found Chantal and the children there, they'd be at enormous risk. Pipe called to warn her. The only other person he could think of who knew about the safe was Nutt. A few days later, a co-defendant meeting was held. Formally, these were occasions to discuss the case, but they were also social gatherings. Pipe approached Nutt. "You know the only person who could hurt you in all this is me and B-Love, right?" he said. Nutt nodded. "So if you snake me, Mo, you know what that is." Nutt signaled that he understood. Pipe continued. "So you know nothing about some kid going in my crib?" "Nah, Mo," Nutt said. "Word to Bear." Swearing on the deceased gangster Bear was the ultimate oath. "Okay," Pipe said. pounding Nut on the back just before they left to return to the cells, giving no indication he knew he had lied. Afterward, he broke away and sidled up to Plowman out of earshot of the others.
"Call Nicole and them," he said. "I want to talk."
Finally, after years of living the street life, lying, deceiving, protecting the guilty, Pipe had had enough. He'd protected Nut for the murder of an innocent man. He'd bailed him out with $2,500 when he got caught in November 2000 pimping underage prostitutes, one under 14 in Hunts Point. The supposed loyalty among sex money murder and the Bloods was a complete farce. Pipe wasn't going to give up his life for a bunch of young Bloods who weren't even part of the original crew. Pete had already gone down so he wouldn't have to testify against him in court. But his crew were just kids in the neighborhood who'd fuck him if given the chance. Pipe was going to protect himself first. The next time he sat down with O'Malley, he agreed to take the biggest step of his life, something that went against everything he stood for. He would talk. As the sessions began, they teased out Pipe's entire criminal history. He found it grueling. He felt like a total sucker, not only for informing, but for having to confess his own crimes, in effect, informing on himself. He spoke about hustling on Cozy Corner and shooting the kids outside the Lafayette Towers at the age of 11. As he spoke, Plowman was the only one in the room who registered discomfort, particularly when Pipe owned up to playing Russian roulette with one of the crackheads after pistol-whipping him, an episode even Pistol Pete had found disconcerting. O'Malley listened, never judging, and never shocked. Pipe detailed murders, drug deals, the inner workings of sex money murder from its inception. Pipe's confession lasted for days. When he returned to his cell after the sessions, he felt wrung out and vulnerable. As he lay staring up at the ceiling, he wondered if O'Malley would screw him. But now he had no choice. O'Malley had warned Pipe that he would become a target. Word of his cooperation reached the street quickly when Chantal was spotted at the U.S. Attorney's Office in the process of being relocated out of Soundview. Pipe was now food. But after half a dozen sessions stretching over weeks, Pipe found that the confessions lifted a weight. "I like you, Pipe," said O'Malley. "Tell the truth, and you and I will be fine." Pipe nodded. "You know that if we hadn't interceded, you'd probably more likely be dead by now." Pipe knew that O'Malley was right, but he also knew that the detective could never fully understand his limited choices growing up. "I just played the hand I was dealt in life, J.O., he said. Outside, Chantal bore the brunt of it. She went from being the respected and wealthy consort of the O.G. to being a struggling outcast. Threats came every day, sometimes directed at her children. A trip to the store became a nerve-wracking expedition. When she put the garbage out, she looked both ways. At night, people kicked her door when they walked past. Female friends she'd gone to get her hair done with, women with whom she'd swapped stories and advice about raising children, suddenly abandoned her. Her two boys walked to school, terrified. Chantal's father worked for Con Edison, and her brother worked as a police officer in North Carolina. They disapproved of her life with Pipe and felt in some sense that this was just desserts. The mother of one of the gangsters Pipe would testify against destroyed his red GTI, smashing all the windows, stripping the car, and puncturing the tires. As Chantal ran out of money, she ran up his credit cards and sold his jewelry. She pawned the diamond-encrusted "The World Is Yours" globe that Pete had given him when SMM was at their zenith. She got $800 for it at a pawn shop on 3rd Avenue in the Bronx. Still, she put $200 a week into Pipe's commissary account and got a couple of new tattoos. On her way to visit him one day, changing trains at Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn, she heard a woman shouting at her, "I know what shit your boyfriend's in. He's a snitch." Chantal had never seen the woman before. Sometimes she brought the two boys, who jumped up into Pipe's lap and asked when he'd be coming home. By sometime in 2002, the U.S. Attorney's Office had put Chantal and the boys in a hotel. None of them felt safe anywhere in the open. They jumped at Shadows. Pipe told her to leave him, that he was done for. But she persisted. They got permission to be married in the MDC.